order the February 17th Civil Law Committee. Ms. Vaught will note the roll. Representative Dee LaForest moves approval of the minutes of the Tuesday, February 11th committee meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Mission minutes are approved as distributed. The next item on our agenda is House File 250. Members, just for your information, tomorrow, originally our agenda listed House File 2041. That has been removed from the agenda for tomorrow. Representative Paulson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 250 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I see there's also an A1 amendment in our packet. I'm assuming this is technical in nature.
Correct, Madam Chair, there's a drafting error. That is correct.
All right, at this time I'd like to move the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The A1 amendment has been adopted. Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'll avoid any discussion. This is the initiative and referendum bill, which many members have seen before and have discussed previous sessions, but it has had extensive review already in the Policy Committee and Government Operations. I think we're here today before you regarding sections 27 of the bill, which is in regard to judicial review. The judicial review section of the bill gives the district court jurisdiction of a suit on petition signatures, conflicts between questions, or constitutionality of adopted measures, and suits would be brought in Ramsey County Court. And that, Madam Chair, is sections 27 of the bill.
All right, thank you. And members, that section 27 begins on line 27 of page 13 of the bill. Did you have any other testifiers that you'd like to present at this time?
No, Madam Chair.
All right, I have listed on my information sheet Mark McAfee. Is he in the room? Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, and as Representative Paulson, we're most concerned with Section 27 of the bill before the Civil Law Committee.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We were unable to come before some of the earlier policy committees, and we wanted to be on. We realized that the primary scope of your hearing today is on that section. But we wanted to state that we are, in general, opposed to initiative and referendum, be on record as really unnecessary, given the representative democracy that we do have. And we wanted to point out, too, that the scope of the bill, I think the real concern we have, too, is that if we have an initiative or a referendum measure come up on the ballot, while any group of the proper petitions can do it, clearly those groups who may be wealthier, better healed would have an advantage. It's interesting that Section 29 of the bill provides for the Secretary of State, at their request, to have links to websites maintained by the sponsor. It also could be an opponent, but those that are able to maintain a website. Also, interestingly, while it prohibits, obviously, people from being paid to sign a petition, certainly one can pay people to gather signatures. So we think it gives an unfair advantage that way. But the overriding thing is we think that you folks as legislators, we know that it's a tough process to work things out, but the process overall works, and that if things have to be given over to initiative or referendum, it's really passing the buck. The people weigh in at each ballot whether we have initiative or referendum or not. But thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. McAfee? All right. Thank you very much for coming to the committee today. Representative Paulson, if you want to briefly describe Section 27 of the bill, and we'll take any questions for you after
okay, again,
that.
Again, Madam Chair, on the judicial review portion of the bill, really the only focus of this legislation is saying that Ramsey County, this section of the bill would be Ramsey County, would be the jurisdiction if there is a suit brought forward dealing with conflicts of questions or constitutionality of adopted measures or petitions. So rather than sort of having a piecemeal approach such as in our Campaign Practices Act right now, it can be in any county across the state. This just basically identifies one county, makes it specific, and makes it pretty easy for those suits to come forward.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for the bill author at this time? Representative Dearnet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious as to why Ramsey and not Hennepin, and also I'm also curious to see if the courts have any opinion about limiting jurisdiction to just one county on a given issue.
To that point?
Just a minute. Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dearnet. Ramsey County, from my standpoint, council may have a comment, or another member may have a comment, but I just figured since we're located here in St. Paul and Ramsey County, it was the only reason that I had picked Ramsey County.
Representative Dearnet.
Just wondering what the court's position is on limiting the power. Have you talked to the court?
No, I have not.
Representative Lippman.
Madam Chairman, Representative Dearnet, I think that the choice of Ramsey County is appropriate. It's a direct analogy to the venue for statewide election contests, which is if there was a dispute over, you know, who was elected governor or secretary of state or attorney general, those things would all be venued in Ramsey County. I think the analogy is appropriate. If there's a statewide ballot initiative, that those matters also go to Ramsey County. So the second district is the venue of choice for, well, since the early 80s.
Thank you. Any additional questions for the bill author? Seeing none, I will renew. Is there anybody in the audience that wanted to speak in support or opposition to this that wasn't on the list? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 250, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Next item on our agenda is House File 1911, Representative Coles. And on the information that I've been provided today, this bill will be referred to the Committee on Commerce. And I have representatives from MetLife and the Insurance Federation speaking in favor of this bill, and Joel Carlson from the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association speaking in opposition. Good. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1911 is a bill that is intended to allow those who our legislature have designated as Minnesota's insurance experts, the Commerce Department, to have an initial opportunity to evaluate allegations that insurance statutes or rules have been violated by an insurance company. The bill is very specific, and it applies only to a limited number of circumstances. Class action lawsuits that include allegations that a carrier violated an insurance statute or rule. House File 1911 is a bill that's supported by the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, or NCOIL, and that's a bipartisan group of legislators with an interest in insurance law. I know for a fact that Representative Davids and Senator Cal Larson serve or are members of NCOIL. I'll explain the bill in just a minute, but I first wanted to state that this bill is not a response to scores of class actions that have been filed in Minnesota on these issues. Our courts have fortunately not been burdened with these types of cases yet. However, there certainly are many class action lawyers throughout the country and in Minnesota who are always looking not only for the next case, but their next venue. This bill, however, would not prevent a class action involving the interpretation of insurance statutes or rules. And I want to repeat that. It would not prevent the class action in that type of case. Rather, it would simply require that the insurance regulators have an opportunity to review the issues first. It sets the foundation for the manner in which these types of cases will be handled when they are brought in Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier, House File 1911 is very narrow in its scope. If you look at Section 4 of the bill, it clearly indicates that it applies only in class actions where the interpretation, application, or violation of an insurance-related statute or rule is involved for at least one defendant. Obviously, this is a pretty small universe of cases. And second, the bill does not preclude or end class actions of this type. Rather, it requires that the court stay the district court proceedings and refer the insurance-related issues to the Department of Commerce for an administrative review. In order to protect the viability of a legitimate class action, the bill provides that the applicable statute of limitations would be told during the administrative proceedings. Following the administrative proceedings, the plaintiffs will have an opportunity to convince the court that any relief awarded by the Department of Commerce was inadequate or incorrect. And although our courts certainly do give great deference to agency decisions, the bill does not bar a class action from proceeding after the agency review has occurred. Madam Chair and members, House File 1911 does not let insurers who violate our insurance statutes or regulations off the hook. It does not prevent a class action in district court. Rather, it provides that our insurance regulators will evaluate claimed violations of insurance statutes and rules before the courts are burdened with the taxing job of overseeing class action lawsuits. I urge your support of House File 1911, and I'd like to introduce Mr. Jim Linnigan. Mr. Linnigan's an attorney with MetLife and has been involved in defending these types of class action lawsuits before, and can also provide some testimony as to kind of the genesis of this idea from NCOIL.
All right, thank you. Mr. Linnigan, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is James Linnigan. I'm an associate general counsel with MetLife in New York, and I'm in the litigation section there and sort of specialize in defense of class actions. I would emphasize what Representative Coles has stated, that this is not a civil justice reform bill per se. This is an administrative procedural bill which it is designed to give the courts considering class actions under Minnesota Rule Civil Procedure 23 the benefit of the views of the Commerce Department on whether a certain policy or practice has been approved by the department. And the court can have the benefit of the expert in the area before ruling as to whether class could be certified or making other rulings in the case, including costly discovery rulings that affect both parties. The genesis of the case, as Representative Cole said, came out of the bipartisan National Conference of Insurance Legislators. The case most discussed that led to this was State Farm v. Avery, which, as many of you may know, is a case that decided in Southern Illinois trial court. It was a $1.1 billion nationwide class action verdict against State Farm. The issue in the case was, should State Farm be prohibited from using with consent and disclosure to the consumer aftermarket or non-original manufacturers' parts in their pairs of cars? Many consumer groups and many insurance departments actually favored this because it made the cost of repairs of cars much less costly. The Illinois courts, despite the fact that there were about 16 insurance departments in with affidavits saying that they approved this practice with disclosure to the customer, and despite the fact that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners filed an amicus brief in which Minnesota joined, I believe the amicus brief was filed in 2001, ruled that State Farm's practice was illegal and allowed this nationwide class action result. That is before the Illinois Supreme Court and awaiting decision any moment. This bill is very limited, that the House bill is before you today, and that is that it would merely state that if a practice or procedure that is in the case was one that came before the Commerce Department in the past, that the court should stay the action, giving the Commerce Department the opportunity to either rule or giving one of the parties the opportunity to get from the Commerce Department its prior ruling on the particular practice or procedure. In many of the cases that come up in this area, in the life insurance area, in the property and casualty area, there have been prior approvals by state insurance departments of the procedure. So we don't view this as a situation where there would be a lot of requests for additional rulings or really any significant cost whatsoever administratively. In addition, armed with the ruling of the Commerce Department, the court could then consider what discovery should be allowed, whether certain issues should be in the case or not. The court would make its own decision based on its standards of Minnesota law and the judicial decisions and all would have before it would be the obviously the arguments of the parties and the rule of the expert in the area. The case would stay in court. There would be no dismissal, no statute of limitations problems caused by a dismissal for the plaintiffs. It's a very limited argument, yet one that would help in the administration of justice substantially and reduce a lot of costs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for the witness at this time? Seeing none, I understand you'd also like Bob Johnson to testify?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lenihan.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be very brief. I think Representative Coles and the gentleman from MetLife had really described the the narrow and modest, but I think important issue involved with House File 1911. I think our Commerce Department, by reputation and the statutes of Minnesota, we have an aggressive, comprehensive consumer protection laws. I think is as good and solid as any in the nation. I think really this is helping to support and bolster and put those front and center in terms of application to consumer situation, and it's I think helpful and strengthens that structure that we have from an enforcement perspective. So we support this bill and urge the committee to pass it.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Seeing none, thank you very much. Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in Minneapolis, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association to express some concerns about House File 1911 as drafted. We think that the bill grants unprecedented protections to insurance entities in Minnesota that find themselves subject to class action litigation. And it mandates a legislative stay of any class action filed against an insurance entity and only an insurance entity, regardless of the merits of the action or the harm that may be continuing during the legislative stay that's imposed by the bill. Class actions, as you know, are intended to promote judicial economy by handling many multiple claims of people that are similarly situated in an expedited fashion, thereby not having to have 40,000 individual cases like the State Farm case they talked about that are individually adjudicated, but rather consolidating them in one action, and that promotes judicial economy and speed. House File 1911 singles out one industry, and it requires an administrative hearing before the Department of Commerce before any action can go forward on the underlying merits of the case. That is problematic for a couple of reasons. Number one, the enforcement authority of the Department of Commerce is limited. They do not have expansive enforcement authority as it relates to individual claims. In fact, the Department of Commerce cannot adjudicate individual claims. And I've attached for the committee their brief website on what enforcement authorities they do have: deny a license, issue a cease and desist order banning certain practices. They can suspend a license, revoke a license. They can impose fines or penalties. And they can refer cases for criminal prosecution. However, the department cannot make determinations related to facts surrounding a case. They're specifically precluded from that. They can't determine the value of property in a case. And so we're sending an individual claim, if you will, for damages to a department who has no jurisdiction or authority to render an opinion as to the facts of the case. And we believe that that is problematic. We also think that imposing a legislative stay as contained in the bill has all kinds of problems for the litigant. We assume that this would come with a stay of any discovery or action on the underlying merits of the case, And it's been our experience and around the country that those types of lengthy delays, once the claim has evidenced itself, that that documents tend to disappear. It gets harder to find the information when they know exactly what it is you're looking for after you state the allegations in your complaint. And so that that stay of discovery upon the claimants to assert their right and get the information to defend their claim is severely compromised by putting this legislative stay in place. You know, there have been sizable settlements on class action cases involving insurance companies. Most recently, doctors have been the most successful beneficiaries of class action practice. They have brought a number of claims against insurance carriers for their practices in the payment and settlement of claims, and these class actions have paid in excess of $800 million to physicians in the past few years. They are doctors are currently the plaintiffs in a class action case against the St. Paul companies over their handling of insurance practices related to their exit on the medical malpractice market. Doctors believe that this case is significant in its costs and ramifications for them, and that is certified as a class. What this bill would do in that situation is it would require the Department of Commerce to investigate, conduct a lengthy administrative hearing, and at the end of the day, they're left with having no authority to fashion a remedy that they're seeking. Now, it's clear that they would say in their complaint that they violated a statute or rule, as is required in the bill. But it doesn't say any of them. It just says the court shall, if an order could be granted in all or part of the relief the claimant seeks. Well, they're certainly going to allege in their complaint some type of deceptive or unlawful practice in their complaint, and so it's automatically going to go to the Department of Commerce to try and fashion a remedy. And it's not just the doctor litigation. Homeowners have used class action cases when the insurance companies have inappropriately set the value of their insurance. When they have I think I've gave an example to the committee in the packet of a $31 million condominium policy, and the problem is it was a $19 million condominium. And if it was a complete loss, the most that company would have to pay on a replacement basis is $19 million. Yet they are insuring the property for $31 million, and they were doing that continually, State Farm, all across their property lines. This would say, and there's certainly nothing that prevents them from doing that, and this would say that the Department of Commerce has to first look at that matter. They can't adjudicate with any type of remedy for the consumer. They simply delay the matter for an additional period of time. This bill will not promote judicial economy. There certainly is no problem with class action litigation in Minnesota, as the previous witnesses have testified to. It just gives an added protection to the insurance industry in Minnesota and causes significant delay to the people that are trying to assert their rights in court in an economical fashion through a class action. Be happy to answer any questions, madam. I did give the committee a significant amount of data about the number and types of, just as examples, stockholder claims against insurance companies, claims against State Farm for overcharging homeowners. There are significant cases against insurance companies that would all be impacted by this, and with an agency that cannot fashion a remedy. Armenian genocide heirs. This was a class action case to settle claims that the insurance company didn't pay from the Armenian Holocaust of 1915. And they had policies in place that they did not pay to survivors. And this would say somehow that the Department of Commerce is going to have to take and adjudicate that claim with a remedy that they cannot fashion, and simply delay the process. They don't have the ability to provide individual remedies. That's been litigated in Minnesota at length, and this bill is a remedy in search of a problem, and we'd urge you to seriously consider these issues when you debate this bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Littman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Carlson, would you agree with me that class action lawsuits in this area are more likely to impact policy changes as to insurance law than a series of individual claims for modest amounts?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lippman, there are no individual claims for modest amounts that can be adjudicated at the Department of Commerce, so I wouldn't agree with you.
Well, Representative Lippman.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Carlson, my point is that amongst two different choices, one being that policyholders would aggregate together in a class action and sue an insurance company, or the other is that they don't aggregate as a class action, but they pursue their claims individually and they have smaller amounts. Which of those two are more likely to have big impacts on insurance law, presuming that that each scenario that they're ultimately successful?
Well, Mr. Carlson.
Representative Lippman, that assumes a hypothetical that is not viable. You cannot directly sue your insurance company in Minnesota but for your contract claim. You cannot sue an insurance company in Minnesota under the scenario you're talking about individually, nor can you file a complaint with the Department of Commerce and have them determine the value of your property. The only thing you can do is bring a contract claim against your carrier, and you have no right to anything beyond your contract damages in Minnesota, unlike 47 other states. You have no right to any additional damages. So if they don't pay your $100,000 homeowner claim in Minnesota, and you have to assert your right and bring a claim, and at the end of the day the court says you're right, that was a total loss on your house, they should have paid it, here's your $100,000. That's all you're entitled to in Minnesota. And whatever you spent to get there, whatever damages you sustained your property during that period of time, are not compensable in Minnesota because we do not recognize bad faith in Minnesota. So your scenario just doesn't apply.
Representative Lippman.
Chairman Holberg, Mr. Carlson, let me rephrase. In comparison to a class action lawsuit as having an impact on insurance policy or individual claims for contract damages, which is more likely to have a bigger impact on how insurance is sold and given and the scope of coverage versus provided?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Lippman, it's been my personal experience in my 23-plus years here at the Capitol that an individual claim and an individual fact-specific situation has brought about more reform than any class action case.
Okay.
That may have brought up, class actions may bring about change in insurance company practices, but it doesn't necessarily follow that brings about legislative or regulatory change.
Chairman Holberg, Mr. Carlson, is there any reason for us to believe that the if a class action were to come to pass, that the views of the Department of Commerce on the issues raised in the litigation wouldn't be useful or of interest or helpful to the district court?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Lippman, they certainly would be the views of the department, whether they had approval for the product, is certainly going to be before the court. What the problem is that something that would be of value to the court, like what's the value of the damage caused by the insurance company conduct, is not within the purview of the Department of Commerce. They can't guide the court in that regard. They're prohibited from doing it.
Chairman Holberg, Mr. Carlson, but as to the interpretation, and I'm reading from page 2, lines 20 to 22, the interpretation, the application, or violation of an insurance-related statute, would the Department of Commerce's views on those topics be of interest, use, or of help to the district court?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Lippman, there's a whole body of law on the deference that may or may not be entitled to agencies in interpreting their own rules. I don't know that the agency is entitled to deference in this particular situation. I think the court has more than adequate tools to determine the conduct of the insurance company, and I don't believe that they are entitled to deference in this particular situation. They're not interpreting necessarily the agency's rule. They're interpreting the insurance company's conduct. Whether or not it complied with the rule is certainly within the purview of the court. and whether or not the insurance in the regulatory agency thinks it's within the rule, they're not entitled to any particular deference in that regard. And in the State Farm case, which by the way was started in 1997, in that particular case, the issue was, yes, the Department of Commerce in that state said that it's okay to use aftermarket knockoff parts when fixing your car. The problem is they didn't disclose that to the consumer, so they're fixing their cars. They have a diminution in value unknown to the consumer. And to have a ruling by the department that, yes, that's allowed, is irrelevant to the fact of whether or not they deceived the consumer when they were engaging in that practice. That was the underlying problem of the case. It wasn't that it was an approved practice. It's what the consumer knew and were sold and what the policies were based on and what the rates they were paying. That was the underlying issue of the case.
Representative Lippman.
Chairman Holder, Mr. Carlson, if the legislature were to find that the Department of Commerce's views on insurance-related statutes and the application of those statutes and the meaning of those statutes in these types of class actions were useful, would you agree with me that the alternative, instead of House File 1911, is to have the Department of Commerce file amicus briefs? Is that the alternative if we don't pass this legislation? And two, isn't 1911 a just much more cost-effective and regular process for achieving those results by getting the views in front of the district court rather than having them go through the irritating and expensive process of filing friend of the court briefs?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman and Representative Lippman, there certainly isn't any indication that the agency's views on a particular matter are any more relevant than what the court feels about the matter. And I don't believe that having that feeling about a remedy that they can't fashion is of any value to the court. I don't think it's of any value unless you're an hourly billing attorney, so you get to go through a lengthy year-and-a-half-long administrative procedure, and then you have to go through a full jury trial in district court. And that's about the only people that would benefit, because their opinion as to the damages is something they cannot render.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to direct my question to Mr. Carlson, but since the author is there, I'd like his response as well. Frankly, I came into this hearing leaning in favor of voting for this bill, but I'm not so sure anymore after hearing some of the testimony. I have a question or two in one or two areas. Specifically, the first, Mr. Carlson, the bill references the period of the stay, that it would be at least 6 months or such other reasonable time as the court may determine. I don't see an end time to the stay. Does this bill therefore create a situation of the legislature granting the ability to place a stay with no ending period of time?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, I think that is exactly the case, because what you would have is, as I read the bill on page 1, the bill contemplates that the Department of Commerce would engage in a contested case hearing under our Administrative Procedures Act. And once that is implicated, before the court can get control of the case again, you have to exhaust all of your administrative remedies, which means you have to go through all appeals on the administrative question, and someone could take a ruling from the commissioner that says the company violated the unfair claim settlement practices, and that the company can appeal that decision. And so what you have here is a situation where you can have an administrative hearing, an administrative appeal that can run all through the gamut, and it's pretty common knowledge that if you are in an administrative setting, before you get to judicial relief, you have to exhaust all of your available administrative remedies. And that is, if that if that decision of the Commerce Department that comes out from a contested case hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act is appealed, you do not get back into court until all of that appeal has run. And so there would be no end date. It would be impossible to set an end date given the scenario of a contested case hearing.
Well, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Mr. Carlson, then conceivably under this language, a stay could be granted and last for a year or 2 years.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman and Representative Smith, I'm personally involved in a case with a county, Lyon County, that I do their permit and regulatory work for that resulted from an inspection at their landfill facility in July of 1994. And that case right now is just at the U.S. District Court on appeal. And that has been an administrative proceeding that's gone on close to 10 years.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
within the same area, then, of this stay, you make some reference in your remarks, as well as your written statement, Mr. Carlson, about the documents and the records critical to the claim can disappear over time, etc. I mean, I know how hard it is to keep track of a pair of car keys overnight. I'm concerned about the ability of a large insurance company with hundreds and if not thousands of employees ostensibly charged with the duty to maintain file cabinet after file cabinet full of documents essential to a claimant. Are there, I don't see anywhere in this bill any special attention or any attention paid to ensuring the survivability of any documents in question. Is there anything that I'm missing here?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I can't find it. And in fact, one of the cases, it's about 7 pages back in the packet that I gave you regarding the physicians that brought action against the health carriers. The insurance companies tried to decertify that as a class. And one of the arguments that the AMA and the doctors made strenuously is that the that they had asked for a stay of discovery during the appeal on whether or not the class would be certified. And one of the key concerns that the physicians had is that during that stay, discovery would cease and they wouldn't then get access at a later date to the documents they needed to establish their claim. So there is no protection for the consumer in the bill relative to that.
Representative Coles, did you want to react or respond to Representative Smith's questions as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to phone a friend and ask Mr. Linehan to come back up briefly. But with regard to the latter point about discovery, we certainly have an extensive body of rules and case law interpreting those rules regarding a defendant's obligations to maintain and produce discoverable information. And this doesn't affect that. This doesn't change that. But I guess I would ask Mr. Linehan to come forward to talk about the first issue that the Chairman Smith raised.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, while he's having a seat, I had one additional question relative to the period of the stay, and that is, I don't believe I've heard any testimony. This deals with tolling of a statute of limitations. I don't think I've heard any testimony or any good reasons why we should, through this bill, tamper with or change or extend the statute of limitations currently in statute for these kinds of cases. And I'm wondering if we could have that addressed as well.
Mr. Linehan.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, taking the last point first, this does not change the statute of limitation at all. What this says is that the class action is filed in the court. Whether or not the plaintiff has met the requirements under the statute of limitations is determined as of the time the class action is filed or filed and served. The reference of this for this stay by the court until to get the Commerce Department views or to see if the Commerce Department has already ruled on a matter, the case would still stay in the court. It would not add to or cause any additional issues with the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations would go back to when it was filed with the court. And this the staying while the Department of Commerce could rule just doesn't affect it. With respect to of some of Mr. Carlson's other points, if I'm, I might address some of your questions as well. First of all, no hearing is required. In most of these situations, such as whether or not use of non-original manufacturers' parts, if they're disclosed, whether replacement policies, how the timing of premiums goes, and so forth, the department has already would have already approved policies or forms which would address the issue. So there's no hearing necessarily necessary, nor does the bill provide for any appeal process through the Department of Commerce, which unduly delay it. In addition to your point about the stay issue and the length of the stay, Subdivision 2, 9 through 12 is very clear that the court itself determines the length of the stay. If the court wants to make it a 2-month stay, a 30-day stay, it can make it a 6-month stay, but the court determines the length of the stay, not the legislature, not the not the Commerce Department, the court. And obviously the plaintiff's lawyer will be arguing for a certain length of stay, the defense lawyer will be arguing for a certain length of stay. And that is just, I think, very clear from the language of the statute. Finally, whether or not the Department of Commerce can issue a remedy really is beside the point, because the court will decide whether or not a remedy can be rendered here in the class action, whether class under Rule 23 can be certified, whether the case should be dismissed, if the class is certified or treated as an individual case, what the damages should be. And nothing in this bill changes that. This merely refers to the Department of Commerce for its views. And when you look at, Mr. Carlson mentioned the State Farm case, which has lasted 7 years, and that is, in that situation, case came in, the views of the insurance departments were ignored, and there's 7 years have gone on in appeals. Various insurance departments across the country now weighing in, and that's because in part there wasn't such a bill, there wasn't such an original reference to the insurance department, which in that particular instance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and as a person that's not a lawyer and coming in here and hearing this bill, I guess it's hard for me to understand exactly all the ramifications, but Mr. Carlson, is it your contention that this bill would in effect limit or stop a lot of the class action suits from taking place?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chairman and Representative Swenson, that's not the concern, and I think the testimony from the proponents is that we don't have a lot of class action litigation going on in Minnesota, so that's not the concern. The concern is in those instances where you do have a class that try to assert their rights, we think this will make it particularly difficult to do so. And the last two pages of the handout I gave you, were a news release from MetLife. And when MetLife recently had to sue AT&T over an unfair trade practice, they didn't have an automatic stay imposed by the court before they could have that issue adjudicated by the court. We just simply don't do that. We allow the courts to make appropriate decisions about discovery, about process, and about the merits. If you read this bill,
Mr. Carlson, just briefly,
if you read the bill, you could have a class action case that is well outside the statute of limitations, and so long as these conditions are met, the court shall stay it, whether the statute of limitations is blown or not. It's got to go to the Department of Commerce for some type of ruling. That just doesn't promote any type of judicial economy. It would be the only industry that we do this for. I'm unaware of any other state that does this. I tried to find the Model Act on the National Conference of Insurance Legislators website. I couldn't find it. I couldn't find any background on it. And I think this is wholly unprecedented in a way of asserting ourselves into the judicial process.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Linegan, did you briefly want to add your points, and then we're going to go to Representative Adkins with an additional question?
Just one brief factual point. The model is on the state on the NCOIL, National Conference of Insurance Legislators website. It's under the state. It's under the Federal State Relations Committee under model laws, and it was passed in December 2002.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Mr. Carlson and for the author. As I understand class actions currently in Minnesota, we've got plaintiffs, we've got a potential defendant. They go through the court process. They pick up their costs along the way. My concern is, with respect to the Commerce Department, class actions by definition can be anywhere from tens of cases to more likely hundreds or thousands or even tens of thousands of cases. Now, if each of these hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of cases goes to the Commerce Department first, what does that do to our Commerce Department? And is there somebody here from the Commerce Department perhaps to address that? And finally, is there a fiscal note for the conceivably dozens of additional Commerce Department employees that would need to be working on it?
Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, Representative Adkins, the bill as it's drafted does not contemplate individual cases going to the Department of Commerce like you suggest. It contemplates a class action, and the issues that are raised in that class action, the insurance regulatory issues, going before the Commerce Department so that the Commerce Department has an opportunity to look at what it's done already. Have they approved a particular form? Have they approved a particular rate increase, whatever the issue may be, and then affirming their previous decision or saying, no, this is not what we approved or not what we did before. So it's not going to be a situation where tens or scores or hundreds or thousands of individual cases are going to be reviewed by attorneys at the Department of Commerce. It's a situation where the issue raised in the class action will come before the Department of Commerce. The regulatory issue raised in the class action would come before the Department of Commerce so that they can take a look at what they've done in the past and affirm what they've done in the past, or say that the insurance carrier was in violation of a particular statute or rule.
Do you get your questions?
Well,
Representative Adkins.
Part of the question was, is there anybody here from the Commerce Department, or did you get a fiscal note?
Representative Adkins, this bill is being referred to the Committee on Commerce, and they will have to determine whether or not there will be a fiscal note. If so, it will have to move on to Representative Gunther's committee, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding was that it was going to come to Commerce Committee as well, but my hope was that we'd be able to, as long as we're talking civil law and the administrative remedies, that we'd have somebody here from Commerce to talk about what the impact and how they'd manage or expect to carry it out. I'll address it in Commerce Committee. The second question that I had, Madam Chair, was the Representative Coles. He said there have not been scores of cases in the past that this would address. Give me a couple of examples. If there haven't been scores, I assume that there have been two or three or five that it would have addressed in the past.
Representative Coles, and if you have any information on the commerce issue as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Adkins, first to the issue of the Commerce Department's position on this bill, they are neutral. They have not taken a position. They are aware of the bill. They have reviewed it, and they have not taken a position on the bill one way or the other. With regard to the second, to your second point, my testimony was I'm not here today in front of this committee to say that this is addressing an issue of scores of class actions that are in Minnesota courts right now. I am not presently today aware of any. There may be some. There may not be. I'm not aware of any. What I testified to and what this bill is intended to do is to set the foundation, lay the foundation for how our courts will deal with these cases when they do arise.
Representative Adkins.
Madam Chair, I guess that's what I'm concerned about, is how, in fact, they would, if there's any cases ever. I'm not just talking about ones that might be going on now, but have there ever been any cases to which your proposed law would apply? You know, Minnesota's been a state for, 150 years. Are there any examples? And if not, maybe you can come up with a case that might come up in the future to which it would apply, so we can at least talk about what the impact would be.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Adkins, I haven't gone back through Northwest Second and Northwest Reporters to see if to see if there ever has been such a case here in the state of Minnesota. But the type of case to which this might apply is the type of case that would be analogous to the Avery situation in Illinois, where a state where state court judges are being asked to make decisions on a national basis or on a state basis, even if it's just Minnesota, what our state's insurance policy ought to be, or what other states' insurance policies ought to be. That's what this bill is intended to do. It's very narrow in its focus, and that's why it's limited to the insurance industry and doesn't apply more broadly than that.
Members, we're going to try and wrap up here. Are there any additional questions for Mr. Carlson? All right, thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wardlow, did you have a question or are you going to pass?
I had an answer. Thank
you. You had an answer. Okay. Representative Biernet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the author for some clarification of legislative intent on page 2, subdivision 2, starting on line 9, this is kind of the point that Representative Smith brought out. You say that the court shall provide that the stay shall be at least 6 months or such other reasonable time. So it's my belief that this could be under 6 months. Is that correct?
Representative Falls.
Madam Chair, that is my understanding, and if we need to work on some language there to clean that up, I'm happy to do that.
Madam Chair, maybe one way is eliminate this. You know, whenever you talk about language giving the court the power to do something or not to do something or to do something that's reasonable, it seems that the court is given broad power, which it already has. And the same as in terms of the claim, on the first page, it says, the court may not or may not necessarily adhere to the action taken by the Commerce Department, but then it could, you know, either way. So it has the right to accept the remedy or not to accept the remedy. So why have all this additional language when the court has such broad discretion? So those are a couple of areas I think that need to be worked on to clarify what it is you're trying to do.
Representative Coles, would you like to comment? Just trying to make those 15 books into 16 books, right?
That's what I'm working on, Madam Chair.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Any additional questions, comments? Any additional comments from the audience? Representative Coles, would you like to renew your motion, please?
Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1911 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
All right, thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion is adopted. Next item on
Madam
the
agenda.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can we have a division on that?
Sure.
Pretty close.
Not a problem. All those in favor, raise their hand. Those opposed? I'm sorry, I was in error. The motion fails on a split decision. So, next item on the agenda is House File 1197. Welcome to the committee. Representative Erickson and I will be happy to move House File 1197 for possible inclusion in the data practices on this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair Hulberg, and this is quite an honor to sit before so many lawyers. I'm glad you're not one, Chair Hulberg, because then you and I can discuss this on the citizen level, and that includes Mr. Wardlow and Mr. Burrell, too. But as I look around, and Mr. Swenson, I'm sorry, it looks like it's loaded with lawyers. This is, House File 1197 makes private the city and county residents of state and local employees. This is a change, and as Representative Hulberg said, I'm here for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill. We're living in a new age, an age that's filled with sometimes threats to our lives, potential threats to our lives, and we have to change, I think, the way that we protect ourselves. I know for years, at least until I was elected to public office, after I became a widow, I had an unlisted phone number, and I did that because I wanted to protect my privacy, and also the fact that I live in a small town. And in a small town, I was very visible as a high school English teacher. I was very visible as an active community person, and I needed it for my privacy. Obviously, when I was elected, I had to change that, and it was quite an adjustment for me. But it's important in all aspects of our life, I believe, that we have an opportunity to protect the resident city and the resident county. Anyone who wants to collect data can still collect the data for research. And you will hear from Ann Schluter, who is here from the Department of Employee Relations, in just a moment, our deputy commissioner. But it is, I think, essential in this new time that we take a look at this. And I'm hoping that you will listen carefully to the testimony that will be brought forth this afternoon. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll yield to Deputy Commissioner Ann Schluter to talk about this from the perspective of the Department of Employee Relations.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Ms. Schluter, if you identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Schluter. I am Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations. I would just like to support what Representative Erickson said in regard to safety, and to make a few more remarks about the points that she made regarding that. We, representing the state as the employer, feel very strongly that making our employees' home, city, and county private data and protected data is necessary for the safety of our employees. The Department of Employee Relations receives requests on a regular basis for information about our employees. This includes everything from payroll to the number of employees in a particular agency, and sometimes it is a request for state employees' names and their city and county of residence. This bill will continue to allow access to all public employees' information in the workplace, including work phone numbers, work addresses, work email addresses, as well as other pertinent work data such as salary. We will still be able to provide roll-up data. This is to say that there is a certain number of state employees in a certain city or a certain county. We believe that the information is critical to an open society, and the challenge today, as Representative Erickson said, is to strike the balance between the public's right to know personal information about public employees versus our employees' right to privacy and safety. We believe this bill strikes that delicate balance. And we have several speakers here today that would like to share with you some of their experiences, either of their employees or their personal experiences at public employees related to this issue. And I would like to begin that with introducing Brian Bergson and Julie Blyle. Brian is the MAPE representative and Julie is the AFSCME representative. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Bergson. I represent the 11,000 state employees that are in the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees Bargaining Unit. We've been trying to do this same thing for a couple of years now, and we're finally able to see this bill hopefully come to fruition. It's something that, especially for our corrections employees, we have been seeing harassment at home, harassment by folks that are out that have an intent that is not good. And so we're very supportive of this bill, and I'm glad to hear that all the labor unions are in support of it. Quite briefly, that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Mr. Bergeson, can you give me an example of what a specific harassment is and the number of complaints that your union is? I mean, how widespread is this and what type of behavior are you seeing?
Yes, Madam Chair. And granted, all of this is anecdotal coming back to us through our locals that represent correction employees. For example, a prisoner will call his friend or buddy on the outside, and they'll find out in what city or town or county our folks live in, and they receive threatening phone calls at home. That's one instance that I can think
and
of.
If I might then, have formal police reports been made? Has there been any attempt to stop this or any steps taken?
Madam Chair, yes, there has been, And the department has been very helpful, too, in trying to keep this data out of their hands. They have told our folks that their hands are tied and that, you know, that they have had to give this data out. And so, yes, we have gone through the police, and the police, you know, in some instances we filed restraining orders and all of that. And, it's just, if we could stop it from happening, I guess that would be the best course of action from our position.
And if I might, does it extend beyond the Department of Corrections, or do you generally see this in the Department of Corrections?
No, Madam Chair, that's just the first one that came to mind. We see it with our revenue investigators. we see it with some of the folks that do environmental action. It's just the things that tend to put citizens on the defensive. Our folks tend to get late-night phone calls at home. And granted, it's not a very widespread issue from our perspective, but some of the instances have been very threatening, and we feel this bill just will hopefully take care of that. Now, if they really want to get a hold of someone, they're probably going to be able to find them, but we certainly don't want to make it easy for someone who has not good intent to find out where one of our folks lives.
All right, thank you. Ms. Belisle, did you have anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Belisle, representing AFSCME. And just to reiterate that we're also in support of the bill, and thinking back to my 11 years of working with AFSCME, this has been an ongoing issue, and we're pleased to see this protection moving forward for employees, and in our case, too, it's cross-agency. It's not just the Department of Corrections. It's all the agencies.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers?
No.
Just a minute. Representative Erickson and Mr. Johnson, your next testifier. Okay. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Robert Johnson. I'm here actually representing a multitude of clients, Teamsters, Local 320, 11,000 members, many of which are jailers, court reporters, other individuals in law enforcement, sheriffs, and local PD departments. I also represent the Minneapolis Police, the professional firefighters, all individuals who at some time or another have had individual threats. Again, as I would speak, it would be like Brian Berkson in an anecdotal kind of a way. But in this day and age, especially our jailers who work in county facilities, are often targets because of this information being available. On behalf of the unions that I represent, we strongly support this bill. Thank you. I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? No. Any additional testifiers in support of this measure?
Madam Chair, Ann Schluter, Deputy Commissioner, I would like to call Jim Pearson, who is from the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Pearson, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Pearson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Petrofund Program at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And this is an issue, too, that we've talked a little bit about. And I, pretty benign thing that I do at the Commerce Department, I'm in charge of an 11-member group that provides reimbursement to petroleum tank owners for environmental cleanup. And when I took that position almost 5 years ago, I didn't realize that I would also have to know a lot about harassment restraining orders, St. Paul Police Department, and Ramsey District Court. But shortly after taking the position in April of 99, I had quite an experience with an angry consultant. He was angry with our program because he didn't feel that his clients were getting just reimbursement over a 2-3 year period. That escalated to the point where I spent several afternoons with then Commissioner Bernstein in Ramsey District Court pursuing a harassment restraining order for myself and all the employees of the Commerce Department against the individual. Also included our board members in that and the like. So that led also to a criminal complaint that was addressed by this St. Paul Police Department, which ultimately led to a conviction of a gross misdemeanor, which carried a 90-day sentence, also a two-year no-contact order and various. So that obviously has been a difficult process, and I think you know, the no-contact order and the conviction is certainly improved my morale, the morale of my staff as well. However, as we get towards October of 2004, when that order expires, we've got a lot of new questions. What then? What happens if it starts over again? And any help that that you could give in helping me and my employees with some with some of these difficult situations would be greatly appreciated. Obviously, it's very difficult to have the St. Paul Police in your office telling you that you should get an alarm system for your house, or if you have a dog, if I own a firearm. It was a sort of a lesson learned when I was given pepper spray to carry with me to my car each night. So certainly any of these things are unpleasant and not what I had signed up for back in April 99. And any help you could give us in protecting some basic information would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Thank you for taking your time today.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'd like to introduce Bonnie Elsie from Deed.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll please state your name for the record.
Yes, I'm Bonnie Elsie, and I'm the director of the Workforce Services Branch in the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm here to talk about the impact that my division has on people who are in distress. I happen to head up state services for the blind, vocational rehabilitation, social security disability determination, as well as some other programs such as job service and labor market information. But under our department, we also have unemployment insurance and the workforce centers. So I'm speaking in behalf of the public employees, not just state, but the local employees that deliver the welfare to work, the Minnesota Investment Act program, as well as some of the others. One of the things that we have found throughout the years is that people in distress frequently act out on things that they wouldn't typically do. When I say we have substantial impact on people's lives, people from our Social Security Disability Determination Unit decide whether somebody is going to get Social Security Disability or not. People in unemployment insurance determine whether somebody is eligible for unemployment insurance or not. People in the work in the infant program make decisions on whether somebody is actively seeking work or not. Across our programs in vocational rehab, we deal with a lot of people who have persistent mental illness. And they deal very strongly with trying to get people the appropriate treatment before they will allow them to enter a training program. So we deal with people in different parts of life that are very distressed. And throughout all of the programs, including at the local workforce centers and the call centers for unemployment insurance, people have been threatened. Threats have not been carried out, but the first time a threat is carried out is one time too many. And it does leave a lot of anxiety on behalf of employees. We have had people literally come to the offices looking for people where we have had to call the police and have them removed. I don't know of an instance where somebody was actually located in their home. But I know that our public employees, both at the state and local level, would feel more comfortable if they knew that at least their home addresses and county of residence were held private.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I'd like to introduce Mr. Gary Westman, Workers' Compensation Division Doer.
All right. Mr. Westman, welcome to the committee, and hopefully you'll have a new story or a new issue to present to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Westman. I'm manager of the Workers' Compensation Program. We self-administer workers' compensation claims for state employees. I won't go on and on with stories, but I can share with you that people in our office do receive threats periodically. Some of those threats are rather direct and include threats of physical harm, and the employees in our office are very concerned about people having access to their home address or their county of residence, because we know how easy it is to locate people through the internet or through any sort of directory service. And we've had They don't happen every day, but when they do happen, the nature of them is quite serious, and it's very alarming to the person that it's directed to the point where we've had people unable to work for the day because of the telephone call they've received or the confrontation that they may have had with a person face-to-face.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, lastly, we have from the Department of Corrections, we have Carrie Carrie Gerlacher and Randy Hartnett from the Department of Corrections.
The alternative is worse.
Yes.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll please state your names for the record.
My name is Carrie Gerlacher. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Corrections Office of Special Investigations.
And my name is Randy Hartnett. I'm with the Department of Corrections, and I'm the Data Practices Compliance Official for the department.
Lucky you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'll just briefly give you a couple stories that I have been involved with since my 4 years at the Department of Corrections. I am the director of the investigative unit and also the licensed law enforcement unit with the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections is definitely in support of this bill. I have two stories involving people that worked at institutions. One of my investigators who was involved in a pretty long, drawn-out drug smuggling contraband story or investigation with a white power group within one of our correctional facilities, who, after apprehension and some legal criminal charges filed against these individuals, about 6 months after the fact, my investigator gets up to go to walk his son to the bus stop in the morning and spray painted in big white letters on his driveway is "Die Now." After doing some phone monitoring, there were some conversations between one of the offenders that was charged criminally in this case and a civilian on the street where there was some very open discussion about the ways that she could go about getting his city and county of residence. Another individual that we had that had an ongoing issue with quite a litigious offender at Oak Park Heights several years ago, after a meeting between the warden, this investigator, and the offender on trying to get some agreement on how this offender would be handled in the future, he came home from work the following day an hour and a half earlier to get some paperwork for an upcoming trial on another offender and found the parents of this individual sitting in his driveway. Also had gotten some information from the school where his children attended school in White Bear Lake that they had been at the school asking about his children. Law enforcement reports were made in all these cases. They're very hard to prove. The harassment cases, there were no direct threats made to that individual. And I think that most correctional employees and law enforcement employees will tell you that they certainly have concern for their own well-being, but when you start looking at your own families and children in your own home, it gives you a real different perspective on what they're looking at.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Randy Hartnett, I want to speak, more briefly about perception. One of my jobs as data practices officer is to provide training to our new employees coming in to the academy. These employees come in knowing that they're going to be dealing with felons. They're aware that they'll be subjected to threats, and we train them how to deal with that. They're aware that they'll be subjected to assaults, and we train them how to deal with that. Then I teach them about data practices, and eyes start to droop, and I can sense that the attention is starting to drift because data practices isn't as exciting as assault and that sort of thing. Until I mention the five words, city and county of residence. Then everybody perks up. That's where my questions come from. Because the concern on the part of the employees is they understand and they bought into the idea they're going to be dealing with felons and subjected to this at work. It's when the possibility of it coming home is brought out to them that they really start to worry. So thank you. And if you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I am so sorry. There is one more. I was told I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Representative Erickson hasn't been to civil law for a while.
Madam Chair, the more the better.
I'm actually in the Civil Law Committee. That's not the case. So welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Tessner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operative Services, Department of Human Services. I'm here today to speak in support of this bill. We operate the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, the Minnesota Security Hospital, and my comments are in particular to those programs. Let me give you one example that will, I think, give you a sense of the kind of problem that staff face. Much like the Department of Corrections, our staff are hired and trained and know how to deal with physical threats when they're on the job. It's when it comes home that it becomes more than they're willing to bear. A situation developed last summer where it came to our attention that a gentleman who was civilly committed as a sex offender was beginning to age and lose function and really not understand how to protect his belongings, his money. He was being taken advantage of by several of the other offenders in his unit. The unit director took action to protect that individual. The day before the action was going to be put in place, in other words, this gentleman was moved off that unit away from the guys that were stealing his money. Our unit director was found in his home severely beaten. From the time that that occurred, we have seen an increased request for this kind of information by the offenders in that program for staff that they work with. They've made it very clear they're requesting that information, and the implied threat is there, that we know where you live. I just want to enunciate this business of our staff are trained. They know how to deal with threats when they're in the workplace. When it gets to the point where they're worried about their family, where they live at night, it changes the dynamic terribly. And I will take any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't believe the Minnesota Newspaper Association is here to speak against the bill, but perhaps they have a representative.
Ms. Nairn is in the audience.
Yes.
So are you done with your testimony
Yes.
in support of your bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak in opposition? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Nairn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Nairn. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. And we're not here so much to testify against this bill as to let the committee know that we think this bill does not accomplish what all the employees hope it will and will most likely just give them a false sense of security. This bill was before the legislature a couple of years ago. Representative Littman remembers that he introduced it, and we spoke at length with he and the Senate author about the bill at that time. And our position was, tell us what problem it solves by removing this language from the statute, and we'll be more than glad to go along with it and help support it. But no one was ever able to tell us how it would solve that problem. And again, I think it's very well-intentioned to try and help employees, but it's probably a bill that's about 10 years too late to do anything to help employees, since we can probably hit up Google on the internet right now and pick up not only their city and county of residence, but their home address, their home phone number, and everything else, and probably a lot more information that would help us track them, license plate numbers and everything. So I guess that was the only comment I wanted to make to the committee, that I do think it does not accomplish what the advocates would like. It may make some people feel good, but I think it's a false sense of security. This provision has been in statute for many years, along with all the other information about public employees, because the public has been entitled to know where that our public employees live in our community and have all that information available to them. But that has basically been our position on this. I don't want to say we oppose it, but we haven't yet been convinced that it will solve any problem.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Nairn? Representative Pugh.
Madam Chair, I hate to drag it out, but Ms. Nairn, would it be possible for a newspaper to find out how many of, let's say, the City of St. Paul's police officers reside in St. Paul otherwise without this provision?
Ms. Nairn.
They get that statistical information anyway?
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, I think it would be possible for anybody to find out that information, including convicts in jail, news media, or any other member of the public. Anyone would be able to find out that information.
Representative Pugh, anybody else? Representative Viernet.
For the author. Just a comment, because Representative Erickson always corrects the grammar, and I think you should have brought this bill just to correct it, because it's so poorly drafted.
Oh, I agree.
The section
I
was
agree.
Added in the middle of the
I
night.
I was hoping you would bring it up.
And it just seems like it was probably added when we had residency requirements and so on
yes.
to make this public, and I think there's no need for this anymore, but I'm glad you brought this bill, and I think it does make sense. But I think you're right, too, Ms. Green, that, that this information is accessible other places now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any
Madam Chair and Representative Viernet, yes, I cringed, but it's what's in law, so I didn't go forth with any of those structural changes that should be made. But, Madam Chair, in summary,
if I might, Representative Levin has a question.
Actually, I was going to speak to the bill. I don't have a question. I was going to.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Forgive me.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Holbrook. I just think, in summary, that regardless of how late this might be, that it is important for the safety of our local and state employees that we make their city and county private data. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Littman.
I was just going to make the observation that, or a couple of observations, one that if we could just stop the use of the Data Practices Act to intimidate folks, the gentleman from Human Services and the administrator of the sex offender program shows that even if the convicts or their associates might be able to get the information elsewhere, that the Data Practices Act request is used to intimidate folks in its operation. That clearly wasn't the intention, but that is how it's being used. And for no other reason, I think we should probably change the law just so that we don't give aid and comfort. Likewise, I don't think that there's much downside, as the colloquy between Representative Pugh and Ms. Niren suggests. The one interest that the newspaper association or the newspapers might have is how many public employees live within areas, and they, as Representative Pugh suggests, can find that out through bulk colloquies without identifying information as to a particular employee. And so I think that the public interest downside is very low, and the upside is great as far as the protection for our employees. I'm just glad that that the public employee unions and the agencies found a much better author this year than they've had in years past, and would urge members' adoption.
That's all I know. All right. Any additional questions of the author? All right. I will renew my motion that House File 1197 be held over for possible inclusion in the Data Practices Omnibus Bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you. Members, we're going to go back to House File 1911 that failed on a tie vote to be moved with a recommended pass to Commerce. I am going to move that bill be reconsidered, and I will be making a motion that it be moved without recommendation to Commerce as an attempt to at least keep the discussion open on this. So my first motion is that we move to reconsider House File 1911. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Right, that motion is adopted. Representative Coles, you want to try moving your bill without recommendation to Commerce and see if we make some headway here?
I think that's a very good idea, Madam Chair. I think that members have raised some issues that need some additional work, and I'm happy to work with members.
All right. Thank you. So Representative Coles moves that House File 1911 be moved to the Committee on Commerce with no recommendation. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion is adopted. Again, members, House File 2041 that was originally put on the agenda for tomorrow will not be heard. And with that, unless there's any other business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
So how are we doing on our? I had a little meeting.
I'm moving along.
Okay.